Mikey, Mikey, Mike.
Yeah.
How have you been, my friend?
It's pretty glorious here. I'm not going to lie to you. This is the time of year where we just dominate. Like, California is wonderful.
I didn't mean weather.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, okay, I won't say that.
That's fine. We've got a lot to talk about today. We're going to talk about the urban and rural divide in your country today.
Yeah.
Which has been changing quite a bit in the last 200 something years. we'll get to that in a second. You're listening to the Americanist podcast. My name is Johannes Ehrmann here in Berlin, and I'm joined, as every time, by my dear friend and accomplished scholar who has just secured billions and billions of dollars, I'm told.
You're gonna jinx me. Don't do that.
From unspecified donors.
No. She's just going to get me fired. No.
I'm just making this up, man. I'm just making this up.
Yeah, I know. Thank you.
That's how I'm imagining life to be like at Stanford University for a man of your...
Stature? Yes.
Yeah. So I hope that some of that funding will also go into our podcast endeavors. no pressure. Yeah, let's get to the topic. Enough with the BS here. We're talking about... one graph, actually, that if you Google urbanization in the United States comes up as the first thing. And it has two colors. The green color is for rural, the percentage of rural areas in the US, or rural population, I should say. And the blue is the urban population. And it, the graph goes from the first census in 1790 to 2010, actually, in this, so the second last census. And the interesting thing is the curve that the blue part is taking at the expense of the green part, of course, because it's a binary thing. Starting off 5% urban population in 1790, so just around the nation's founding. And it has come up to now more than 80% at this moment. I pulled up the numbers as well. The first census saw 3.73 million rural population versus just 200,000 urban. And 2010, which is the last number here, saw 59 million rural versus 250 million urban. Yet, you guys vote for your president in early November, after the harvest has been brought in and before the winter hits. And in order for your horse carriages to best travel from the countryside to the next town... Of course, you also vote on a Tuesday so that all of Monday can be used for that same horseback travel after all of Sunday is, of course, reserved for worship in your local village church.
Right, yep.
And you can be back in time for the weekly farmer's market. So that's quite neat. And then, of course, very importantly, and we definitely need to talk about that as well, you allot two senators to each of the 50 states so that's important. Wyoming... can have the same representation as your lovely California. The only problem, maybe, is that there's around about 68 Wyoming populations fitting in one California population.
You know, you and I didn't plan this part right here, but like, I maybe about a month ago did some calculations, and exactly on the kind of stuff you're talking about. If you look at Wyoming, their voters, and then you look at the Bay Area, so not California, but just like sort of San Francisco, San Jose, the area around here. If you took 5% of the voters in the Bay Area, not all California, and you move them, if you just randomly pick and you move them to Wyoming, Wyoming would now be a Democrat stronghold. there are so many people in California, not even California, the Bay Area, that we would overwhelm Wyoming in its voting.
So it's, how many Tesla factories is that?
Yeah, there's a real, you are exactly right. Like one of the major exports of California is Californians. We have been moving companies to Austin. We've been moving companies to Nevada. Like, you know, there's a narrative there about California sort of losing jobs or losing companies, but there's also another really important narrative, which is the philosophies and the economic output of California is moving into other places, and we're changing a lot of the ideologies and thinking of some of these communities. But you're right, like three or four major corporations move to Wyoming, and Wyoming is a very different state. Yeah,
but that's probably not going to happen, right?
Wyoming would be a tough, yeah, that would be tough.
Well, it could be a new utopia, you know. Musk could set up his own city or world. Oh, or...
he might do that. He would. Oh God!
I'm gonna DM him just after that.
He's on Twitter all the time.
I mean, he has a big factory that's being built just outside of Berlin. So
is that true?
Maybe no, I see him on the airport the other day.
You might.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't think he's flying the airlines that I'm flying, but. I guess instead of the green for the rural, we could have just put red for Republican. And the blue, the blue remains the same. I mean, that's sort of the rough divide, right? I mean, it's not always true, but in a lot of places it's true that Republican voters tend to, I mean, the red states, that's sort of like the lesser populated states.
You are right that a lot of the states that are less urban, less dense, tend to vote Republican. But it's actually probably even better to think about within states nowadays. Mm-hmm. There are still like very, like if you look at the cities, if you look at places where like there's a lot of density, those almost all are blue. Those mm-hmm. are almost all Democrats. And then even within states like California, a huge swath of California is very red, very Republican. And that those are the areas where it's, you know, farming communities, you know, rural communities, that kind of stuff. So you're right that states, when you sort of average up or you gross it up to an entire state, that pattern kind of holds true. The more rural states are the red ones. But even within those states, you know, if you look at like Louisville, you know, like that is a very red state. And then, you know, a blue area. If you look at Austin inside of Texas, very blue, very Democrat, maybe even more liberal than some of the areas right around where I am. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it really is the urban rural, even inside of states, that's mm-hmm. holding mm-hmm. the sort of political differences.
Or Pennsylvania as well, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Which was, of course, and we had this famous episode about our dear Philly deciding the election in November. When was it? November 2020, right? It's not 2021. But actually, rural Pennsylvania is pretty red. So it holds true there as well. So you grew up in Maine. And you grew up in a rural setting, right?
That's right. Pretty rural, yeah.
Okay. And so how was that like for you?
You know, wonderful way to grow up. Mm-hmm. You know, and tight-knit community. We were small enough that we had to... My high school drew from 5 neighboring towns in order to get like, mm-hmm. you know, 100 people in our class. So it was a pretty, you know, small community. And I guess I don't know the exact numbers, but, you know, a large percentage of the folks from that I hung out with are now living in urban areas. Mm-hmm. Almost all of my friends mm-hmm. are.
That's interesting. Migration. So there's this shift actually that has been going on in the last 20 years in your immediate surroundings, right?
That's right. Yeah. So, yeah. And it has to do with jobs. It has to do with like prospects and that kind of stuff. Yeah.
So, and that's what has been drawing people to the big urban centers, right? For the last 150 years, I guess, or even more.
Yeah, that's right. There's really a, so you have to track a couple things. And I don't know the exact time. I think it's sort of like the, you know, 30s, 40s, 50s, there was a real policy to try to level the playing field. Like that there was an obvious migration into cities mm-hmm. and people were sort of worried about losing strong rural connections. And so they started like, you know, the central government, you know, Washington, D.C. started putting money to developing like, airports and infrastructure and roads in order to make sure that the rural communities could really thrive. So there was a real large investment. And that was also an important part of making sure that other policies that we have, which I think are really American, and if you want to understand America, you have to understand that we really think a lot about property ownership. Like, so a lot of the narrative of being an American is getting a house and owning property. The land claims. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And we have this sort of expansion mindset and growth mindset. Not in the sort of psychology sense, but like trying to continually build larger. And so
That means that the rural becomes suburban and the rural sort of retreats, but it also means that we put a lot of national resources and attention into developing things to get us into the rural area and back into the urban.
It's very interesting that you would mention that, because I've actually, and you know that I'm researching this book, I've talked a lot about it here,
On,
that is set in the revolution times, when still 95% of the population was rural. And just the other day, on Netflix, I actually discovered a great two-part movie. I don't know if you've seen it. It's called Saints and Strangers.
Oh, no, I haven't.
Yeah, it's really worthwhile. And I mean, so much on Netflix is trash, at least in Germany. And this thing, I mean, almost as worthwhile as watching Cristiano Ronaldo's wife being bored to death on a luxury yacht in Monaco. Because it's actually about, you know, real history, real people that had a purpose and believed in something. It's about the experience of the Plymouth Pilgrims when they encountered the Indians. Or the Native Americans, I should say. And you mentioned the expansion, right? So this was for the English Empire, the British Empire back then. I mean, the Pilgrims they wanted a new world for themselves. They wanted basically their religious utopia. But the English Empire wanted to expand, and that's why there were English colonies, and then there were also French colonies, of course, until the Seven Years' War in North America. It just reminded me of that this idea of expansion and basically in the land, that's why I said the land claim, you know, those were the very first sort of, and very, very poor little settlements that Europeans tried to establish. And of course we sort of know the end of the story. So for me, it's also, I guess, what you guys want to be or what you guys, where you guys come from as a nation, that you still have not left behind in a way, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Oh no, I cannot agree with you more. I think that's a really perceptive look at us, which is that at sort of our creation myth as a country is built on expansion. We did it twice, like two or maybe even three times. So in the very early days when we sort of were, you know, the different forms of Americans were, I guess European Americans were thinking about what it meant to move to America, there's that. And then we had the westward expansion during sort of like cowboys kind of time, you know, like setting the West and like, you know, what did that mean? And then we had another real one during like the 30s, 40s, 50s, during the sort of New Deal kind of time when it was an expansion in ownership models, but also like sort of educational kind of stuff. And so, yeah, man, I mean, like, it is a little scary when I stop and think about what it means to be Americans, because it is sort of consuming and growth. And it's almost like, this is like the least flattering way to describe it, but like a cancer sometimes. It feels like we don't reach like a homeostasis, or we don't reach a sort of, oh, I'm content and I'm comfortable. And things are like, you know, we've reached a sort of good place. It's always this like striving to make more and do more and that kind of stuff. And you're right. It's really embedded in our narratives over and over again. We sort of cycle back to it a lot.
I want to quiz you on one thing that I found very, very interesting. The first American city, so the prototype, like the prototypical American city, do you have any idea which one that is?
Oh, geez, man. You know, it's got to be Philly, right?
And it's actually, so it was founded by William Penn in the fall of 1682. And he brought the whole city plan with him. So there was nothing. There was just woods and a little fort. You know, Pennsylvania, Penn's Woods, you know, the Latin name. And very interestingly, actually, he just wanted to call it Sylvania. He just wanted to call it woods because, you know, he was a Quaker. He didn't want to feel entitled to this so much. And he wanted to deal with the Native Americans. And then the king actually overruled him. He was like, no, this is a land. It has to have a European owner. So it's Pennsylvania, Penn's Woods. And the funny thing about Philadelphia is that it was planned to be everything a European city was not. So it was planned with like wide straight streets in a perfect rectangular grid instead of, you know, this narrow medieval mess of, you know, alleyways, dark corners and pestilence, whatever, you know, all the... with the big public parks, you know, where important streets would meet, you know, like Rittenhouse Square. This is this was all there in the very beginning. Oh, yeah. It was all laid out like that.
Yeah. Pointing this out, it makes a lot of sense because there's a lot of symmetry, right? Like the city itself, you know, there are sort of these point, you know, these major lines and then parks that like mirror each other. And so that has to have a human intentionality to it.
Penn was extremely egalitarian in that he wanted everyone in the city to live on same sized lots of real estate. So originally all the little lots of land that he would sell to people had more or less the same size, so that everyone could have a little garden to cultivate some plants or to recreate with the family. And this was all like absolutely new. And then also the way of naming the streets, you know, the east-west streets, you know, they're all named after local trees, right? Walnut, chestnut. Back then there was mulberry, pine, cedar. Some of them have been renamed. And then, of course, the very typical American thing now that for every European is so weird, the north, south, just by number. You know, for easy orientation, I guess.
It's the Cartesian plane, man. We love it.
What is that?
The Cartesian plane. It's the graphing, mathematics. Yeah, we just stole it from Descartes. Number lines.
I didn't even know that. Okay.
Oh, I'm mostly joking. But like, that is the coordinate system that we teach our kids. Yeah.
It was thought of by Penn as a green country town. That was his quote. So actually, it was a city that was never supposed to be a city.
That's absolutely fascinating. It makes sense given how laid out it is, but I didn't realize that at its inception it had that sort of hybrid of density, but also sort of egalitarian and green to it. That's really cool.
Yeah, he had the whole part that is today Center City was basically the original plan between the Delaware and the Schuylkill.
Yeah.
And he had it all laid out. And in the beginning, I mean, there was not nearly enough people for that, but he knew there would be more people coming. And then by the time the American Revolution came around with 40,000 people, Philadelphia was actually the biggest city in North America, with New York City 25,000 and Boston 15,000 following. And by the way, London at that time already had 750,000.
Oh, wow.
So, so there were huge cities in the world, but just not in America. Today, of course, very different, right? What's your favorite American city, actually? Because there's so many of them.
Yeah, there's a lot of them. I mean, San Francisco is just unbelievably beautiful. I mean, like, I know it's like...
I can attest to that.
Oh, gosh. It's, you know, let's see. Like, so I love Austin. I really love Boston. Boston was like sort of my first major city. Like when I was living in Maine, you have Portland, Maine, which is wonderful. But Boston was really the city. And this goes back to the, like, sort of the American understanding. When I grew up, I spent all my time in these rural areas with people I knew, and thinking about going to even Portland, Maine when I was younger was kind of scary. Like the city is such a foreign or different place. It was like, you know, there's so many people and there's so much action and there's so much energies that I don't understand. Maybe that's just me. Maybe I'm just like a little like weirdo, but like the cities were serious things and we were not of that. And I think that persists. And you can see that in sort of the politics that, you know, the some of the rural areas don't think of themselves as the same thing as the cities. The cities are a different thing, like a different culture or different,
almost like a different country, you know?
Almost like a different country. And it's sort of interesting because, like, not in always, right? Like the sports teams and that kind of stuff, we all sort of, but, you know, there's been this nationalization of identities. And so the if you're rural in Maine, you may end up using rural sort of culture from the South. So you will see things like the Confederate flag, which has sort of become
Maine.
Yeah, you absolutely will. I mean, you even see in Canada right now. And it's sort of used to represent not the South per se, like in and of itself, but like the Confederate flag.
The way of life?
Yeah, the way of life and the sort of independent, and I'm not going to agree to centralization of control, and you can't. So it's wild, right? I mean, the Confederates were these losers who lost rapidly to the North.
They
were slaveholders. These are horrible people, right? Like over and over again. But like now it's taken by a certain kind of identity, which is, and it's not, and I'm not, I want to be very careful. That is not the way all rural people are at all. But you are seeing a nationalization in the United States of rural identity. And so you'll see these transporting of things, of sort of cultural icon or iconography, or like these like icons into different places in the country that don't totally make sense to do that. But yeah, I mean, that's why you sort of have big urban cities thinking of themselves as more related to one another, even though they have very different substrate, like, you know, different like economic inputs and stuff. So
that sounds pretty crazy. But I guess this symbol that used to stand for something has now morphed into something else, the Confederate flag.
Yeah.
So some people use it to express some kind of, I don't know, maverick character that they have, or something non-conformist, non-urban.
Control, like separate, I can be independent or separated. So is that the only interpretation? No, it's got a lot of real crappy stuff tied to it, like, and there's a horrible racist tradition built around it, and like, it's not, if I see it, like, I think a lot of us recognize those parts. But why does it show up in northern Maine, or why does it show up in Canada? I mean, like, right now there's, I'm not sure if this made like international news, but like in Canada there's this like trucker, you know, brigade that's like sort of blocked up part of the federal government in Canada. So like truckers have moved in the city and they've sort of blocked things off, and they're flying Confederate flags. Makes no sense at all if you sort of trace the history of it, except for once you realize that it has a set of meanings about like sort of rural identities in North America.
So obviously there is a problem here, right? I mean, and we've seen it in the last elections, and apparently for the first time in the 2000 election, it really became apparent that, you know, the country and the cities were very, very distinct in terms of like divide red and blue. And this has, and I mean, Trump has taken that to absolute extremes, right? And I remember us talking about, because there's also a third category, it's rural, urban, and suburban.
Yeah, that's right.
And I remember you talking about how suburban voters first basically put Trump in office and then voted him out of office as well.
Yep.
4 years later. Yeah. So suburbia also has this very American space.
Yes.
Right? That's right. Sort of the illusion of country living with like gardens, space, and quiet. But they're part of they're part of the metropolitan areas.
Absolutely.
It's not the countryside. It's not Wyoming.
That's right. Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And it's sort of, it's really complicated because it's sort of the suburban acts in different ways in different parts of the country. So here in the Bay Area, the suburban areas are sort of intimately bound up and connected to the city. So there will be a lot of commuting into the city. So a lot of the energies, the workaday business class moves into the city during the day and then pulses back out at night. So it's really oriented towards that. Other places it's not. Like you will get, you know, suburban areas that function as things that will eventually grow into cities. You know, they sort of have their own identities and that kind of stuff. But a lot of them are oriented towards the city, but they're making choices about like, I want to own more land, or I want to have a more of a feeling of independence, or I want to, you know, be able to get out into the country. So it does tend to sort people.
So it's again this very sort of historical white American feeling of land claims and independence. I mean, this is all tied together, I guess, right? Even the Confederate flag is tied into that.
Absolutely. You are seeing things clearly. This is one thing that really matters to me. Like, I see this as one of our tragic flaws. And it's not that I dislike the suburbs, but we made an intentional set of decisions with our policy. So we put a lot of federal financial support into people owning and purchasing housing. We subsidize mortgages. We give a lot of tax benefits to people who own land. And so if we were to pull that away, I think a lot of the suburban people would have to move into the city. The sort of density, the supports that are offered make suburban areas, you know, livable. And I think if we were to change a lot of our policies, you would get people sort of having to choose. And they mostly move into the city, given how a lot of stuff functions.
But if that would happen, then the divide would even be greater, right? I mean, then yeah. Wyoming would even have less people comparatively well, to the metropolitan. I mean, Wyoming might remain stable, but then, you know, Bay Area and other, or New York or
that's right.
whatever, will still grow and grow and grow.
Yeah, it would have major implications for places like LA or something like that. And the reason I call it like problematic or like one of our original sins is it what it means is we consume so much more. So there's the housing themselves, but all of our transport, all of our cars, all of our maintenance of the roads and the rebuilding of infrastructure over and over again to support these, like, oh, it just kills me. It breaks my heart. Like we sort of, we've tied ourselves to putting resources into the upkeep of bridges and roads and that kind of stuff that we don't necessarily need to. We can move people into the cities. And so I do really worry about that. It's just not sustainable into the future.
Or move more people into the countryside. I mean, this might become attractive as well.
Yeah, that could. And I think what you would end up with are sort of denser, under this idea of like the United States not obsessing about home ownership and land ownership, but like sort of having a different model. I imagine that a rural environment might look more like places in Europe in the rural areas where you have a city core, or not city core, but a town core. Where a lot of people live, and then it's like really is sort of green around. Mm-hmm. Some of our rural areas, or a lot of our rural areas in the United States, don't look like that. You see a lot of dotted housing that's sort of like spread because everybody owns the plot of land.
Yeah, exactly. The individual plots of lands are quite big.
That's right. That's right. So it's a parsing up or parceling out of the land that I think is, I mean, it's interesting. And like, there's been a lot of wealth creation through that, but I just don't know if that will continue in the future. And I worry that we've lost sight of what actually makes people happy. I imagine there's a good way to make people happy by getting them closer together so they can interact, so they can like build, you know, like cool things in restaurants. And like, maybe I'm oversimplifying here, but I think some of our isolation in the United States is because we have pushed people out to the peripheral because that's where you can own things and you're separate and you're living on in your own. And I think that what that leads to is some of, I believe this narrative, I'm not sure if anybody's proven it, but like when you look at the cities, we interact with people. We're forced to because we move around. Yeah. And so we see people who are not like us and we see people who are, you know, from different backgrounds and we just become more used to it. And by flinging people to the outskirts of cities, into the suburbs, or further out into the rural areas, you just don't have as much experience. I know that was my personal journey. Is like, I knew, a couple hundred people when I grew up, and that was it. And I got a little nervous when I didn't, when I was interacting with people who were not of that. Yeah.
Sure. Sure. And some of that might be just, sort of the amount of stimulus that you get in for your senses, right? The noise, all the like different, maybe instead of seeing 10 people on the street, you see 500 people.
Absolutely. I remember the first couple of times I like the first week I was here in San Francisco, because I'd basically been in rural areas. Even my undergraduate institution was in the middle of nowhere. Very rural area. And when I got to the city, like I almost couldn't sleep. There was just too much noise. I kept waking up and being worried and little country kid.
Poor young Mike.
Yeah. Nervous system.
little country Mike.
Yeah.
And where you are right now, is that, would you characterize that more as like a suburban area? Or?
Yeah, where I am right now is a suburban area. It is what everybody would call like the Bay Area. I'm on what's known as the peninsula. So this is basically, I'm at the sort of probably the northern tip of Silicon Valley, maybe. Okay. And so, yes, there are these two major American cities, about 30 minutes north of me is San Francisco, about 30 minutes south of me is San Jose. I'm relatively close to Stanford, so I'm within biking distance of Stanford where I teach. So yeah, this is very much a suburban community I'm in.
So you're saying basically this cannot be reversed, this trend, or we should actually move more people into the cities. Let's just assume that for the moment that, and it's also very difficult to sort of reverse these kind of cultural trends and these kind of cultural myths that have also been created around suburbia. And I mean, even I've grown up with probably 90% of the movies I watched as a teenager or a child were set in American suburbia.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. And so if we assume that, and let's tie that back to the political problems or the binary divide that we had in the beginning. So what do we do with the Wyomings? We just take some senators away from them? Or?
Yeah, okay. So that was not the direction I thought you were going to take that question. you curved me out. So first off, I want to acknowledge that, like, me saying something about, like, pulling financial support, federal support for home ownership, that's terrifying. That would be a major, like, wealth for a number of people would be just stripped away, right? So it's I'm not saying that we would do this right away or overnight, but I do really worry that, like, we are making Americans feel worse about themselves, less healthy, and those kinds of things by these unintended policies that were built around growth and from, you know, 200 years ago and then reinforced like 100 years ago. Like, it's just, you know, so I worry that we haven't been very serious in thinking about what makes America awesome and will make it continue to be cool into the future. And we're stuck with some very big burdens left over from other parts over time. But I also want to say, like, I understand that, like, what I'm saying is a little crazy, and, like, to slam it into place would be horrific. It would be awful to make those policies. So,
but I guess, I mean, a first step might be to just sort of modernize the voting system, right? I mean, because this Tuesday, it's a problem for a lot of people.
Yes.
I mean, it might have been for the best of people. I think it was created in the 19th century, this voting day on a Tuesday. And also Tuesday, early November. So this is actually not from the late 18th century, but some decades later.
And I think. I just wanted, like, there's one other little hiccup there where it's like it's like the first Tuesday after the first Monday, and that's because, like, there's this weird quirk for a holiday that used to be important to us, but is, like, lost to memory now. It was like, yeah. So it couldn't be like the first. They didn't want it to be like the first. It was. So whatever, it was the day after the first day of, like, November, but it's, like, lost to history. So there's a bunch of weird things that are just left over. And it's not easy, you know, like, so just to point this out and sprinkle a little hate on you guys, it's not like we had a chance to restructure our government the way some countries did.
Because they messed up big time.
Yeah, there's also a little, yeah. Like,
and, we're bailed out by certain other nations.
Yeah, you had other nations to help you rethink about what you might want to be into the future.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's true. And it's one of the oldest democracies.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's a source of pride, but also, I mean, creates some problems because...
We get some legacy stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and because you are so proud about your constitution, there's, I think, a big hesitancy to change it or to... Yeah,
absolutely. No,
amended.
That's right. And, you know, things like, you know, one of the things that you pointed out twice and I want to engage is, like, the voting day or, like, those kinds of, like, voting issues. There is a real incentive to not change those because it does make it harder for certain kinds of people to vote. If you are a working person, you don't have a lot of resources, maybe you're providing care for your kids and your parents, and, like, to get to vote is a really hard thing if you have to, like, take time off from work. So it would make sense that we made it a national holiday or we paid people to go and vote and stuff like that. That's not going to happen because, I mean, it should happen. I want to be very clear. It should happen, but it won't happen because one of the political parties, the Republicans, would find it really to their disadvantage to get a wider swath of the voting population engaged. Right now, they are a minority party. They are, you know, approved by a minority of the United States. And to, you know, get larger, closer to sort of democratic idea, or, you know, democratic ideals of, like, sort of one person, one vote would not advantage them. So there's some real structural power issues that preclude us making common sense, very useful changes to how we vote. Could reach a crisis point. I mean, I'll be honest with you. Like, there's some real issues going on where in the not too distant future, people are getting disenfranchised and it may not be sustainable. And I think if I was a Republican, I would be very concerned because the slow moving tactics they have been using, sort of making sure that people they don't like can't easily access the vote, that only holds for so long. Like, you're holding back a dam and it could be a very bad for them in the not too distant future.
Because in essence, it's undemocratic.
It's very undemocratic.
I mean, both in a literal and in a...
That's right. Yes, yes.
In second sense.
Big D, small D. Yeah. Let me also say this explicitly, is like, you have pointed to, we are not democratic, right? Like, so we, you know, the Senate itself was designed to have equal power on the state level. Mm. Our House of Representatives was designed to have something more proportional to the size or the population.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Senate,
and it changes. The ratio, right, in the House of Representatives,
that's like, right,
California, every census gains a few seats.
And that's right. I should know this number, but, like, you know, let's say that, like, I forget, we have something like 60 House of Representative people, but we have two senators. If you look at Wyoming, they have two senators and I think two representatives. So, you know, we have a lot of power because we're larger in California, but not in the Senate. And we have to sort of pass things through the Senate. So that is becoming a real big source of tension. And, but there are real discussions, like I mentioned, you know, I was doing some calculations the other day and I've seen other people talking about, well, what happens if certain parts of the country start purchasing land and moving to Wyoming? Like, there's there's a large number of us, we have good resources, you know, what would that mean? And there's a real concern. I've seen this on the Republican side, watching Californians move into Texas. The sort of compositional shift is there, and people are sort of concerned about those kinds of changes. So refocusing on the urban rural, I don't know how it's going to play out into the future. But there was a major, I mean, if you look at the maps, like, it is very obvious that within states, even, the more dense areas have a very different view of what the future looks like and how we should govern ourselves versus the rural areas. And it's not totally clear how we reconcile those.
Well, maybe you guys just need another utopian thinker like William Penn.
That's right. Build some new cities.
Who believes
this is what, circle back,
maybe in a, like, new, in a new commonwealth, and has a has a city map plan for some areas in Wyoming, Vermont, or other places in store. And I guess we're going to come back to this topic some other time as well. It's going to accompany us. Of course,
I mean, also you really can't shifts. Get away from it. It is a very core part of the American.
And it's an existential shift that's taking place demographically and politically.
It is.
All right, that's it for today. Please do subscribe to us on Apple, iTunes, Spotify, and all the places you listen to us. Leave a favorable rating. Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, and thank you folks for stopping by. We love to, you know, share this with you.
See you soon, man. Take care.
See you, man. Bye.